sexual repression,
castration anxiety,
the Freudian slip.
Keeping track of where Freud has influenced us is very difficult, and it's certainly not just in the intellectual realm.
Why has Freud had such a lasting legacy?
Haven't psychologists today totally abandoned Freud's ideas?
Everything in Freud comes out of Shakespeare. Hamlet's where the Oedipus complex comes from.
Were Freud's theories scientific?
Think of him alongside James Joyce or Franz Kafka, rather than alongside some 19th century scientist.
If Freud's theories were so unscientific, then why are they so widely recognized still today?
You're leaving out the sex part.
Our guest is Paul Robinson, author of Freud and His Critics.
What I discovered in Freud was you really can't change.
You honestly think that I tried to run you over?
Well, what would Freud say?
Freud would say I really wanted to run her over. That's why he was a genius.
The Legacy of Freud.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner across the bay at the Stanford University campus. That's where Ken and I hang out and philosophize.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, it's the legacy of Freud.
Well, Ken, I know that lots of people see Freud as one of the towering intellectual figures of the 20th century.
And rightly so, John. He was the father of modern psychology, the founder of psychoanalysis. Now, he wasn't the first to think about the idea of unconscious beliefs and desires.
Well, he wasn't the first by a long shot. That was Epicurus's idea 2,000 years ago.
Oh. Okay, I grant you that, but unlike Epicurus, John, Freud developed rich and detailed scientific hypotheses about the exact workings of the unconscious mind. I mean, he single-handedly changed the way we all think about ourselves once and for all time.
Well, Freud's theories were rich and detailed, I give you that, but they were false. All of his main ideas, from the Oedipal complex to penis envy, castration anxiety, his obsession with sexual repression, all of it just turned out to be wrong. And in addition, his views are just shot through with patriarchal and sexist dogma.
Oh, John, you're being way too harsh.
I don't think so. I don't think I'm being too harsh. I think the scientific establishment would agree with me. There's probably some psychoanalytic cult that continues to worship at the feet of Freud the master. Some people still take Freud quite seriously in literature. And I suppose even to a certain extent in our own discipline of philosophy. But genuine scientific psychologists? No way.
Oh, come on, John. The details of Freud's theory may have fallen out of scientific favor. I'm willing to grant you that. But the scientific spirit of Freud, that still lives. What was Freud's greatest insight? His greatest insight was that most of what goes on in the mind is hidden from our conscious view. He taught us that the conscious self is the result of a complex interplay of subterranean forces. Now, I'm willing to bet you dollars to donuts that every single post-Freudian scientific psychology still believes that.
But the details matter if we're talking science and not just, say, literature. Take his tripart division of the mind into the id, the ego, and the superego. That's a pretty theory, a nice theory. Ripped off from Plato, of course, but nevertheless, quite pretty. But it's just false. There's not a shred of empirical evidence for it. Despite Freud's protestations to the contrary, in the end, his theories were not scientific at all.
Oh, come on. Just because a theory turns out to be false, that doesn't mean it's not scientific. By that measure, John, Newton's theories aren't scientific either. But that's an absurd view. Not even you believe that.
Oh, come on. Newton was one of the greatest scientists in history. You can't begin to compare Freud with Newton.
Of course you can. Come on. Freudian psychology is actually related to modern psychology in exactly the way that Newtonian physics is related to modern physics. Sure, modern psychology has superseded it supersedes Freudian psychology. Okay, but modern physics supersedes Newtonian physics. But nobody, not even you, would say that Newtonian physics is totally false or unscientific. So you shouldn't say the same thing about Freudian psychology either.
But there's a big difference, Ken. Newton's theories are extraordinarily good approximations of later physical theories. They're still useful, used every day in engineering. You can't say anything like that for Freud. Penis envy isn't even approximately true. It's just plain false.
So, Ted, why are you so darn determined to deny Freud his due? I don't get it.
Nothing personal. Just healthy dose of scientific realism.
Are you completely sure about that? Did you have a bad experience with a Freudian psychoanalyst or something? You know, that would explain your behavior. Maybe you're repressing your resentment and sublimating it into obsessive compulsive scientific realism. Would you like to talk about it, John?
Please, spare me your armchair psychoanalysis. You could leave that to the so-called experts.
Well, I'd be happy to. Actually, you know, I'm really curious to know what practicing psychotherapists think of Freud today. Do they see him as a Newton-like figure on whose shoulders they all still stand? Or are they like you and they'd rather forget about him and consign Freud to the dustbin of history?
Well, to help us answer those questions, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch. She went out to explore modern psychotherapy and Freud's continuing relevance. She files this report.
What do you think of when you hear the name Sigmund Freud?
The Oedipal cycle?
Leather couches upon which we lay while getting psychotherapy?
Think of the id?
I think of this axiom of Freud's that my father likes to repeat, which is that Freud said that facial hair was an attempt to genitalize the face.
Okay, I couldn't find any proof for that last one, but other words come to mind. Freudian slips, anal retentiveness, and of course, penis envy.
These are ideas he gave birth to in the context of a patriarchal, misogynistic, turn-of-the-century society.
Neil Brast is a psychotherapist in Palo Alto, California. Though many of Freud's theories seem preposterous today, when Brast found Freud as a young student, the work resonated with him. Brast admired Freud's concern, his thoughtfulness, and curiosity, and it gave him hope.
He had a curious, interested, and non-judgmental approach to people. He prescribed to practitioners how to construct an atmosphere of safety in the consulting room through things like neutrality, curiosity, interest, confidentiality.
When Brast is with a patient, he says Freud looms large in the room. After all, Freud helped invent the talking cure, or psychotherapy, in the mid-1890s, and he helped develop the rules that almost all therapists use today.
Freud recommended that we listen to people in a different way, that we listen beyond the specific story that they're telling us, and hear the underlying emotions, the internal struggles, and what is not being said.
Before Sigmund Freud, man believed that what he said and did were the products of his conscious will alone. But the great psychologist demonstrated the existence of another part of our mind, which functions in darkest secrecy and can even rule our lives.
Unconscious mental processes are ubiquitous, and we're not aware of them directly. In a sense, we hide from ourselves a lot of what's inside ourselves because it's unpleasant.
In the final year of his life, Freud was interviewed by the BBC. It's his only known recording. He had oral cancer at that point, and speaking was incredibly painful.
People did not believe in my facts and thought my theories unsavory. Resistance was strong and unrelenting. In the end, I succeeded in acquiring pupils and building up an international psychoanalytic association.
Freud's contributions, particularly his ideas about the unconscious, live on for Neil Brast. But the psychoanalyst also admires Freud himself. The man who lived through the Nazis, supported his extended family during war, and battle painful cancer in the final decade of his life. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin, for that interesting perspective or set of perspectives on Sigmund Freud. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley, California.
Our guest today is a professor of history at Stanford University, teaches extensively about European thought in the 19th and 20th centuries, and he's author of Freud and His Critics. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Paul Robinson.
Good to see you, Ken.
Paul, you're an intellectual historian, not a psychologist. So what got you interested in this guy, Freud? Or do you have some painful memory that you're repressing and don't want to talk about it?
No doubt. I got interested in Freud when I was an undergraduate, and it's a long time ago. And I started getting the idea I might become a scholar, an intellectual historian of the 20th century. And if you want to do that, Freud looms large as a figure you've got to come to terms with. So there's a professional element here, but there's also a personal side to it. It's got nothing to do with penis envy, Oedipal complexes, or anything like that. But Freud sort of came to my personal rescue, in a way, when I was an undergraduate, in that when I went to Yale, I became a serious Roman Catholic. Went to Mass every day, and was involved in a profound effort at self-transformation, as Christians are supposed to. Thought I could make myself into a better and maybe a really different human being. And Freud sort of rescued me from this project.
There you go.
It was the story, and what I discovered in Freud was the proposition, you really can't change like that. Ah. Learn to live within the, you know, accept the kind of fundamental thing you are. It's not going to change.
Accept who you are, and if you need to hire a shrink to help you.
Yeah, which I never did. I've never been analyzed, so I'm in that sense innocent.
So in terms of intellectual figures, is Freud just intellectually interesting because he kind of had a big impact? Or is there something worth believing in his theories?
I'm not sure about believing. If you're an intellectual historian, you don't think in terms of, is it right or is it wrong? I think about Freud the same way I think about Marx, and in a certain sense about Darwin. I mean, these are monumentally influential, novel, and complex, or ambitious thinkers who attract our attention not because they're right or wrong, but because precisely of this innovativeness, this imaginativeness, the largeness of their intellectual ambitions.
So look, you're an intellectual historian, and it's certainly true that if you're an intellectual historian and you're imagining the intellectual influence of Freud in the 20th century, it's massive. Of course, there's many spheres of Freud's influence. There's literature, there's to a lesser extent philosophy, and then there's psychology, psychological science. Now, where would you say Freud's influence has been the greatest? Is it in literature and the humanities, or is it actually in the psychological sciences? I mean, that's a historical question.
Yeah, that's a good historical question. I think his greatest influence has perhaps been outside the intellectual realm. It's, Dr. Spock's baby book that we've all been brought up on, deeply influenced by Freudian thinking. So keeping track of where Freud has influenced us is very difficult, and it's certainly not just in the intellectual realm. I don't know a whole lot about modern psychology as a science or as a profession. I think it varies. In my university, they have nothing to do with Freud, as far as I can tell. He's a relic, an incorrect relic. But I think there are other places that are more sympathetic. See him as an important forebear.
I got to tell you, when I was an undergraduate, I started out as a psych major in the 70s, but the psychology professors where I was at Notre Dame in those days, they were all still behaviorists, and they definitely thought Freud was a relic, and they taught it as just a budget of mistakes and misguided things. But if you were to ask whose influence is greater now, the behaviorist or Freud, then I'd still put my money on Freud on that one.
Even in that era, psychology has many parts, and personality theory was always kind of non-behaviorist and influenced by Freud. Maybe it didn't show up at Notre Dame as much as it did elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true. So it's a sort of weighing up Freud's influence, given all the spheres in which he was influential, is a kind of complicated thing. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. We're asking about the legacy of Freud. Our guest is Paul Robinson from Stanford University.
Freud proposed a scientific study of the mind through psychoanalysis. But were Freud's own methods really scientific? Or should we consider his views pseudoscience?
Freud, science, and pseudoscience, along with questions from our non-repressed audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Because instead of one head. I've got two. And you know two heads are better than one.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is historian Paul Robinson, and we're talking about the legacy of Freud.
Do you think of Freud as a pioneering scientist of the mind or as a pseudoscientific charlatan? And what would Freud say about what you think? Does his thinking resonate with you? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage.
Paul, so when John and I were talking earlier, John was really dismissive of Freud's theories as kind of pseudoscience. Now, I'm not sure that's a fair picture of Freud at all, but let's start with his own self-conception. How did he think of himself? As a scientist, a literary critic, perhaps even as a philosopher?
No, he thought of himself as a scientist, no question about it. Although some people, as you suggested, tried to rescue him from this self-identification, particularly Habermas. He made a mistake when he claimed to be a scientist. He's really more like a literary critic. But he thought of himself as a scientist.
He borrowed a lot of ideas from philosophy. I mean, he borrowed a lot of ideas from Plato, the three-part division of the soul. He was heavily influenced by Nietzsche, I think. But I have a sense that he didn't actually think much of philosophy, even though he cribbed philosophical ideas.
That is absolutely true. He was contemptuous of philosophy, even though it's been proved he took a lot of philosophy classes when he was a medical student, particularly from Franz Brentano, took a course on Aristotle.
So why was
he knew
so
more about philosophy than he let on.
So why was he so contemptuous of philosophy?
Because he thought philosophers could say anything. Yeah, he did. He thought it was just hot air.
Well, if philosophers can say anything, then it would be surprising if it was all hot air.
But they would only accidentally. Okay, but look, so he thought of himself as a scientist. He thought of psychoanalysis as a scientific undertaking, as a scientizing of psychology. But, I mean, okay, where all these theories of his come from that today have, I got to say, almost no scientific credence? I mean,
you're thinking penis envy. Everybody's
penis envy. Envy, yeah. Crest. No. Castration anxiety, all these personality theory, you know, anal retention, all that sort of stuff, this arrested personality stuff. There's no evidence for any of it. So how did he convince himself of that stuff?
Well, he was a man of, as has been said in the setup, he was a man of his time, of the late 19th century. Freud was 44 in 1900. Long prep, you know, his education is in the 19th century. In a way, he's no different from Marx in claiming to be a scientist. Everybody in the late 19th century who wanted to be taken seriously claimed to be a scientist. And Darwin, of course, claimed to be a scientist, and his claim to be a scientist was contested in the late 19th century, saying this is just a fanatical idea, natural selection, that Darwin's come up with, and he's manufacturing evidence to make it out that it's empirical. So the issue here is, what do we mean by science, which is a historical thing?
But I think Freud himself would have said, well, you know, I have a lot of empirical evidence because I talk to people who are troubled, and then I try to develop theories that makes the best sense of it, and then I also look into other bits of evidence like literature
dreams.
And so forth and so on, and then dreams. So what do scientists do? They come up with theories that make sense of as much of the data as they can. So I don't have any trouble with Freud thinking of himself as a scientist.
Yeah, I get your point, John, but here's something that has always puzzled me. For a long time, it's puzzled me. Freud's influence in psychology, I mean, there's one enduring, as we said in the open, there's one enduring insight that Freud had, big and important insight, that the conscious mind is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
And it's a complex subterranean stuff going on there. Hardly anybody believes that the unconscious mind operates along Freudian principles anymore, but almost everybody believes. In some sense, we're all Freudians now to that extent. Okay.
Yes.
But here's the thing that used to puzzle, I haven't thought about it in a long time, used to puzzle me a lot. Okay, as the scientific influence of Freud waned, his influence in like literary theory and places like that was like going full buzz. Right? What explains that asymmetry? How could Freud persist as influential in the humanities but while his scientific influence was waning?
Well, one way to answer that would be to say he was a literary figure, an imaginative figure from the start. That's what Harold Bloom says.
Right.
He says everything in Freud comes out of Shakespeare. Hamlet. Hamlet's where the Oedipus complex comes from. And that we want to understand Freud's enduring or continuing influence, think of him alongside James Joyce or Franz Kafka rather than alongside some 19th century scientist.
But I mean, what if you think of it this way, that look, think of Future of Illusion, Moses and monotheism. Maybe those weren't central to Freud's project, but he really gave us a complex way of dealing with a lot of phenomena that Christianity dealt with that was a totally different, intellectually rich, very applicable and maybe too applicable, coming up with explanations for things. And it, as an alternative to a religious system,
oh, absolutely.
It's great.
I agree with precisely those books. I mean, Freud is an analyst of and critic of religion resonates profoundly with me in The Future of an Illusion or in the Moses book, which is really asked the question, what's distinctive about Judaism? Mm-hmm. Why does anti-Semitism prevail in European history?
So, if Freud were around now to see his reception in the 21st century, and you could see, and he could see that, well, you know, in certain kind of literary cultural interpretation circles, he still has some kind of influence and some kind of hold on the imagination, while in scientific circles, he has far less hold on the imagination. Would he be disappointed by that?
I think he would be. Yeah. But maybe he would be pleased to see that he's such a big name. You know, who knows? He might be very happy. I thought it might be over by now, but here I am, big time.
Freud certainly, in various places, is what we would now call some kind of physicalist. That is, he thought he was ultimately talking about the brain and structures in the brain. I think he'd be very disappointed to find that brain science isn't further coordinating with his views.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the legacy of Freud in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we've got some questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am.
Hi, thank you. My name is Melanie Light, and I'm from Berkeley. And I don't really subscribe to the facts of Freudianism. It seems to me that you guys are talking about this in a very binary way. He either is or isn't a scientist. But it also seems to me like with math, if you go far enough out with math, you get to philosophy. Can't there be some kind of more unifying point of view to be more inclusive?
That's a really good question. And I do think that Freud had a noble ambition and one that I share. That is to ground cultural interpretation and the interpretation of human behavior and the narration of human behavior in at least partly in sound science. So the continuity between science and cultural interpretation is something that Freud was a big advocate of. And that's a noble ambition, but it's got to be sound science. You can't take the scientifically grounded cultural interpretation and then say, well, the science doesn't matter. I don't know. What do you think about that, Paul?
No, I agree with you. I have the American prejudice, as Freud would have called it, that this, when you come up with these ideas, you need some kind of outside controls, some kind of control group in which you don't have the analyst present eliciting these interpretations. So I think there's something to be said for that. He has scientific ambitions. He doesn't live up in practice to what you'd have to do to make the assertions so scientific.
On that point, now there is a well-known critique by Adolf Grunbaum that is mostly aimed at his scientific methodology, and feels that Freud fell short by his own standards.
Yes, it's exactly what Grunbaum says.
Is Grunbaum right about Freud's ambitions?
Yes. Yeah. No. I'm not. Whether or not he had scientifically methodological views, that may be a stretch on Grunbaum's part. But there's something to it.
We got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Brent Green, and I'm from Kensington, nearby. And I was wondering if you would make a comment or two about Freud's contribution to dreams and whether or not we can resolve drives and problems that we're facing through dreams, and perhaps dreams have a cathartic effect as well to heal us.
I pay attention to my dreams, and they never seem to correspond to the kind of dreams that Freud talks about. One of the big problems in his dream theory was, how do you explain anxiety dreams? Because the hypothesis in Freud is that dreams are wish fulfillments.
Right.
All dreams. And the wishes originate in childhood. And when I look at my dreams, I have academic dreams. I'm like, should I do? I'm going to the wrong room for my lecture. What's the wish?
I'll tell you. So Freud's theory of dreams, in one sense, has very little credence among psychologists who think about dreams. But here's something that Freud did do. Again, let's contrast Freud to the behaviorist. Freud was much more of a cognitive scientist, in a certain sense, than the behaviorist psychologists were. The behaviorist psychologist basically said, the mind's just this black box. It's got no inner mental mechanisms, right? And we just talk about behavior. Well, that theory has a whole bunch of problems, making sense of dreams. The behaviorist, so there's two great psychological movements in the 20th century, behaviorism and early 20th century, and Freudian psychology, and then cognitive science arises. Behaviorists couldn't make a tale about dreams. At least Freud thinks of dreams as some complex psychodynamic, the outcome of some complex psychodynamic process. Now, nobody believes he got the psychodynamics of dreams right anymore. Dreams are really complicated stuff for psychology today, but still, you know.
Well, as I understand the situation, I mean, Freud, in the interpretation of dreams, has a long argument just to convince you that dreams aren't just random, that there's something going on. And he points to earlier theories about dreams as foretelling the future and so forth. That's people's recognition of at least that. Nowadays, I think the most popular theory of dreams is it's like when you're doing the it's cleaning out the files of your computer.
It's the memory.
And so you're just like trying to read the random stuff on your computer when you're ditching all the redundant files and old things and trying to make sense of it. I must admit, I think the truth must be somewhere in between. I mean, I have too many recurring dreams that involve the same anxieties over and over again. I've somehow lost my job at Stanford because they found out I didn't have an undergraduate degree. And so I'm back in college trying to finish my undergraduate degree, and I have to take a math class, and I just can't get it. I mean, I have that dream maybe, you know, once a month. Now, I don't think a random file cleaning system would come up with that. So I think there's something in between what Freud's right.
But I think you're not being fair to the contemporary theory. There's a lot of work about dreams. And here's a Freudian element, but not at all like the details of Freud in contemporary thinking about dreams. It is all this random stuff being generated. It is like a memory dump. But the mind is an inveterate interpreter of its own goings-on. And so this random stuff makes the mind say, what the devil is going on there? And so we throw out these confabulated interpretations, just like we throw out confabulated interpretations of our waking life. So the theorizing, confabulating part of the mind, that's not Freud, but it's not that far from Freud. But we've got another question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, thank you very much. My name is Neil Talkoff, and I have to tell you, I am a psychoanalyst in San Francisco.
Oh, good. We need you. Are you a Freudian psychoanalyst?
I am a modern relational psychoanalyst who teaches Freud.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, what's your question?
So we should talk. Okay, here's my question. Let me float a proposition and you can tell me what you think about this. Maybe one way to think about Freud is that he was more of a philosophical scientist in this sense. Much of what he says we don't take seriously anymore, but some of the basic principles, for example, the existence of the unconscious, is given in Western society. So maybe it's not so much a question of was he or was he not a scientist, but how do we think about Freudian psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic theories and what works and what doesn't work?
I think that's good. I mean, that's what I was saying in the opening. I mean, I don't know how psychoanalysts today think of the details, the Freudian mechanisms. I mean, is there still any credence in Freudian mechanisms in psychoanalytical circles?
Is there still
some credence that it's approximately true?
Absolutely. But we also are very aware that, you know, these theories stopped developing in 1938.
Right.
And we've been thinking about this for another 80 years.
Right. So I wondered if you could regard Freud as like a Newton-like figure on whose shoulder all subsequent psychologies, at least to the extent that we all believe in the unconscious and that it works by mechanisms that we have to discover, and they aren't just given to us. In some sense, we're all Freudians. All psychologists are post-Freudian. But in terms of the details of the mechanisms, that's the hard part.
I like the comparison with Newton. I think that really works.
Do you think that works, Paul?
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you entirely.
So I wonder, in psychology in general, not psychoanalysis in particular, but in psychology in general, how is Freud taught now? Is he taught as just, well, here's a cool guy with some interesting ideas that we no longer believe, but they're not really relevant? Or is he taught like Darwin's taught? Darwin started an inquiry going that led to Darwin didn't have a theory of how replication worked. We got the Mendelian gene that filled in something, and then we got the discovery of DNA that filled it in more. So there was this progression from Darwin to the modern genetic synthesis. And Darwin's a crucial thing in that. Is Freud like that? Is he like the Darwin of subsequent psychology, or is he just a wrong turn? Can you answer that?
Not the Darwin. Now if Marx is the guy who claimed to be a scientist, who we think of as least scientific in the 19th century, and Darwin is the one whose claim stands, Freud is somewhere in between. I think he's an intermediary figure. That's why some people are claiming the way to revive him is through literature interpretation, and others still cling to the notion that it can be rehabilitated as science.
So one issue we should pick up in the next segment that we haven't talked about is the relation of feminism, the rise of feminism, and the decline of Freud's theory.
They go hand in hand.
That's a really
they
good
absolutely
question.
Absolutely go hand in hand.
Well, let's dig into that in the next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're analyzing the legacy of Freud with Paul Robinson, author of Freud and His Critics.
Freudian slips, penis envy, the Oedipal complex. We're all familiar with these concepts. We use them every day. But do they have any real merit?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our live and lively audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our live musical guest, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Our guest is Paul Robinson, author of Freud and His Critics, and we're digging into the legacy of Sigmund Freud. And John, I want to go back to John's question at the end of the last break. You told this touching story about how Freud liberated you from a misbegotten project. But you know, Freud's influence isn't just... cultural influence isn't just good. He had female sexuality so wrong, so completely, utterly wrong. It seems to me a liberation to get beyond Freud's theory, especially of all human sexuality, but especially of female sexuality. What do you think about that?
No, absolutely right. And the Freud's downfall, or his fall from grace, which began in the 70s and blossomed in the 80s, this is when he comes under attack, began with feminists. Who said not only that the female psychology, penis envy and so forth, was wrong, but that it was positively hateful and damaging.
Yes.
And,
right.
You know, Kate Millett, I'm thinking of, or all the people who wrote books attacking him. And, you know, I'm on their side entirely. So I think, you know, again, he's a figure of the 19th century. He's a patriarchal thinker. He always thinks of everything in terms of the male case. Women are... afterthought.
Are envious males.
Envious of males.
Which is probably evolutionary.
It may make
just
evolutionary
the
sense.
Opposite. Men are the afterthought.
Yeah.
But
I want to expand on this. Okay, so looking at all the influence of Freud and literature and our culture and our cultural practice and our self-conceptions, I mean, would you say it's a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, if you admit the feminist critique of Freud is correct, I mean, so I've heard Freud dismiss as patriarchal, misogynistic, right? And he has this huge cultural influence. If that is correct, if his influence was largely patriarchy and misogyny, that means unbalanced is better to consign.
More bad than good, you mean?
Is it more bad than good?
It wasn't good? Like he came up with misogyny and male dominance.
No, but he gave it the imprint of scientific psychology. Because whenever you have a cultural movement and it's backed by the hegemony of science, it gets even more powerful. So it's even more important to not let him have that credential as grounded in science.
Yeah. Kate Millett said the patriarchy was just about dying out at the beginning of the 20th century. And along came Freud and rescued it with a new idea, you know, which set women back. And I mean, I don't quarrel with that. I think the value of his thought can survive critique. I think it's, you know, the idea of the unconscious, the idea of the pervasive influence of sexuality, particularly younger sexuality in our lives, in our experience, can survive the excision of penis envy and of the usual.
Really? Why?
Oh, I think so.
I mean, look, as John pointed out, Epicurus, Plato,
yeah.
Nietzsche, well, he was a misogynist too.
And Plato
was a misogynist too. Anyway, but the idea of the unconscious goes way back. Now it's true that we kind of lost that with Descartes and all that, but Nietzsche was a big deal bringing that back. But so if the only thing we get out of Freud is that there is an unconscious whose mechanisms we need to really probe to understand human psychology, and we reject all the rest of it as misogynistic patriarchy, I don't think he gets to have much of a standing reputation.
Well,
the guy who took us in a hugely influential wrong turn.
You're leaving out the sex part. Maybe because you want to focus on penis envy, but the and it's deeply unfair to attack people on the grounds that they're repressing, you know, to attack your intellectual energies. Oh, the problem with you, buddy, is you know you've got that's you know, ad hominem argument. It's totally unfair, even when it's true. It's unfair.
As it usually is.
Yes.
But you were about to say about my rejection of Freud as a
I think the way in which he, if you think of him coming after the Victorians, brought sexual experience back to the center of the way we think about people. Not just as a random or occasional thing, but as the center of our experience. I think that's a long-term influence that makes him, you know,
there's something
seminal.
connected with the feminism issue I want to learn from you about. There's this whole seduction hypothesis, and some people are very bitter about that Freud had an idea that could have really been influential in focusing on the amount of child abuse that goes on, then he shied away from it.
Yeah, this is Jeffrey Mason's critique of Freud, that in 1896, in the early 1890s, he advanced the hypothesis that all mental illness, all neuroses in every individual were caused by seductions in childhood, real seduction, sexual seduction, usually by a parent or a relative. And he advanced this in several papers, and then a year later, in 1897, publicly abandoned it, and said he had been wrong. These seductions hadn't happened to all of his patients, but that in many cases they had simply been imagined and maybe even wished for. This is referred to as the abandonment of the seduction hypothesis. And people in the 1980s, like Jeffrey Mason, and some feminists as well, accused Freud of having abandoned a really important insight because he was afraid that his fellow doctors would condemn him for it because it was so obviously outlandish. Mm-hmm. So he got, when we were incredibly preoccupied with child abuse in the 1980s with those daycare cases and school cases, Freud came in for attack once again, not for having talked about sexual experience in childhood, but for insisting that some of it or part of it came from inside the child.
So now since then, there's been all this stuff about false memory.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of those daycare workers have been freed and got big settlements. Has Freud's reputation along these lines been somewhat resuscitated as a result of that?
You would think that would be the fair thing to happen, but no, he gets it from both sides.
They both
think he's bad.
I just think it's overdetermined. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Thank you. My name is Carola. I'm from San Francisco. I have a question for Professor Robinson. You said earlier that when you meet new people, you do interpret their behavior according to unconscious motives you might attribute to them. But then you also just said that it's ad hominem to attack someone on a basis of a repressed belief they might have. And I'm wondering, if there is no empirical evidence for these unconscious motives, don't we have an obligation to try and rid ourselves of this way of evaluating and interpreting each other? Or is there some good or something actually accurate we can get at by using these Freudian unconscious motives at interpreting each other's behavior?
I think it's wrong to use these as a tool of argument when you're having an intellectual debate with somebody else. I think you can't say, you just say that because something had happened to you in childhood. But I don't think we are any longer capable of divorcing our interpretation of people from unconscious thoughts.
If we were really having an argument, I suppose I agree with you. But I think so much that so many people say is driven by unconscious agendas on their part, and that we post-Freudians, post-Nietzscheans, because this was a big deal with Nietzsche too, I mean, it would be, and contemporary modern psychologists would say human beings are great confabulators of their self-images and all that sort of stuff. We can't get back to the day where there's just Plato's seminar room. It's not, that doesn't happen.
If you're a college teacher and you deal with freshmen, these great bundles of parental expectations, hormones, what they used to call in the dorm DSB.
What is that?
Dreaded semen buildup. and you're sitting with them there in your office, and you hear their story of why they're here, why they're upset, or this, that, and the other. You just can't help but construct a theory about what's really going on. How much is the parental expectation? How much is fear of parents, so forth and so on? So in a way, I mean, you don't sit around and think about penis envy and stuff, but it is hard to approach people without constructing theories that we might not have thought of if it hadn't been for Freud. Maybe not. I mean, Epicurus wouldn't have jarred me into it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, my name is Anne. I'm from El Cerrito. In her book, Ordinary Losses, Judith Viorst relied a lot on Freud's theories about loss from the womb and from early childhood, and I'm wondering how much resonance that still has today.
I don't know the book. You'll have to tell me more.
Tell us a little more.
A little more, yeah.
Well, I think I just did. she talked about how an individual's growth develops out of the loss initially of the womb and then of the breast, and then all of the losses that we experience growing up from birth through the loss of our parents, through the loss of our youth, all of that.
See, this sounds Freudian to me, I must say it sounds pretty plausible too.
But this is the difference. This is the thing. Okay, as an author, as an interpreter of text, you're free to adopt, it seems to me, you're free to adopt any sort of scheme of interpretation that makes coherent sense of whatever it is you're trying to interpret. The human narrative, you're free to adopt, and that's what we do. We humanists adopt interpretive schemas of all kinds. And some of them are wildly implausible, and some of them are, if they make sense, we feel good about this. And I think Freud, over decades, has had a huge influence in the interpretive humanities, in any interpretive discipline, right? And that goes back to something we said earlier. I mean, if he were to come here and say, oh, yeah, the people who are in the business of interpreting humans, a lot of them still resonate to what I said. But then the people who are in the business not just of interpreting but explaining in a scientific way, they've abandoned this stuff. So the humanities are not constrained by scientific interpretation. I would like them to come together, and I think Freud wanted them to come together, but I think very often they come apart.
Yeah, but I want to enter a note of skepticism there. Psychologists, whether they're Freud or Skinner or modern psychologists, just love to run off at the mouth about stuff they don't really know beans
That's
about.
True.
They do a few experiments, and then all of a sudden they tell you there are no character traits. Well, I mean, that's a pretty big claim.
That's true.
What they've actually discovered is that character traits don't determine your behavior in really marginal and unusual cases. Let's say no character traits. So there's the humanities on one side, there's physics on the other side, there's economics and psychology and the social sciences in between, in which there is a little bit of empiricism, there is a little bit of constrained theory making, there is some quantification, and then a spate of often best-selling bull poop.
Yeah, this is certainly true. There's an old distinction, an old German distinction between Naturwissenschaften and Geisteswissenschaften, and how to reconcile these things, or if you can, you know, the natural science and the spirit sciences, the human sciences, how to reconcile these two things and their different methodologies, that's a big question about which we ought to do a show sometime. So, Paul, I'll give you a chance. You got any last closing comments?
No, except did I mention W.H. Auden before already? I can't remember.
No.
When Freud died in 1939, Auden wrote a poem in which he said, He's no longer a person now, but a whole climate of opinion.
Okay, well, Paul, on that profound thought, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Our guest has been historian Paul Robinson from Stanford University. So, John, the author of Freud and His Critics. So, John, do you know what you're thinking now?
Do I know what I'm thinking? I have the surface. I know on the surface what I'm thinking. I know what I'm consciously thinking. I like to read Freud. He's a great writer. I mean, he wrote Future of an Illusion and then much later Moses and Monotheism, which actually, if you take the two of them, you have a critique of religion like we're getting from a lot of people nowadays, plus in Moses and Monotheism, and also an appreciation of the positive side of religion. So I think he was an extraordinarily insightful guy who published a lot, some of which is way off base.
Yeah, and he was a great cultural critic. I don't deny that. And he had a great ambition to ground that cultural criticism into real science. It's just the science that he, I'm pretty doubtful about that. Pretty doubtful. But you know, this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blago. I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our tweets on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
Now, I wonder what Freud would say about a guy who talks really, really fast. Maybe he's trying to hide something. Let's find out by listening to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, in pop culture, the subconscious used to be as real as a dime. Now it's just another blank space for advertisers. I don't think I've seen a therapist in a major role in a movie or TV show since The Sopranos. And even there, it was kind of a joke. The mafia guy has a shrink, ha-ha, until Tony started killing people. Freudianism drove much of 20th century pop culture. Where would Woody Allen movies be without shrinks? Or Psycho, which had the shrink popping up at the end to explain what went wrong with poor Norman Bates. And psychoanalysis was glamorous. Remember Spellbound, the Hitchcock movie? With Ingrid Bergman as the analyst, Gregory Peck as the troubled yet dreamy amnesiac, Dream Sequences by Salvador Dali. Remembering randomly, there were Sixth Sense, David and Lisa, the president's analyst, the Three Faces of Eve. My favorite was Forbidden Planet. Didn't really have a shrink, but it was way Freudian. An entire planet was destroyed by monsters from the id. For years, cartoons, fiction, movies, and television were peopled with handsome women wearing horn-rimmed glasses and lab coats, pipe-smoking men with goatees and sweaters with patched elbows. The frightening hidden was revealed and trotted out for us as reasons why the killer killed, why the beautiful woman stole things, why Jimmy Stewart couldn't help Kim Novak, why no leading lady would ever marry Gig Young. And this trope of smooth-voiced men and women with the ability to glibly yet deeply explain the inexplicable bled over from psychology into improbable physics. Monster movies always had some pipe-smoking, deep-voiced scientist to explain things to his fiancée or little Timmy. Instead of analyzing a troubled hero, he would analyze a troubled monster, either deciphering why it wants to keep us out of the Black Lagoon or what secret weapon might kill it. 50s movie scientists were turned into figures of authority, dragging up secrets to which only they knew the answers. And what about the rest of us? Psychoanalyst and movie fan Andrea Sabadini told the English paper The Guardian, quote, people who hide in the dark of a cinema for hours a day are certainly trying to avoid something about reality. There's an element of addiction which is close to being pathological, unquote. Well, that's certainly overanalyzing the movie-going experience. We hardly even go out to the movies anymore. When we do, theaters aren't really womb-like, are they? They're more like 3D echo chambers full of loud noises and flashing lights. Not a place for true cinephile neurotics. Today we stay home, watching movies on our big screens, stopping and starting them at will. The only experts left on TV are on cooking channels or makeover shows. We don't even have experts in movies. Well, we do, but they're the secret identity of the nerds who turn into the superhero. If we have shrinks, they're usually evil. Silence of the Lambs, remember? That movie ends with one evil shrink stalking another, about to kill him and eat his liver with fava beans and a nice Chianti. I don't get it. Well, come on, ghost of Norman Bates. Turn the tables, appear unto us at the end of that movie, and explain it. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman and Erica Sokolowicz-Shane, and also to James Hanley.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon and Crystal Nickerson.
The program is produced by the brilliant Devin Strolovich. The one and only Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our Marketing director is the smooth and suave Dave Millar, and Carola Kreitmer is our performance consultant.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the views of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable, as they often are. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.